So I was actually quite happy when Randy asked me a few months ago if I would come lead a discussion with you all on this, because I had started to see this kind of topic both in the press and around the MIT campus and so forth. And one nice thing about an MIT, being an MIT faculty member, what you realize is learning is the most interesting thing. So being asked to lead a discussion gives me the opportunity to learn. So the one thing that will become clear, so I might as well tell it to you now, I'm not an expert in this particular field. I've tried to learn enough about it to formulate some of my own ideas and to help lead a discussion with you all. But I know there's other folks sitting at these tables here who know more about some aspects of it than I do. So it's a discussion. I've got about a half hour worth of material, by and large, so we should have plenty of time. I want to motivate it by the sort of thing that came to Randy's attention and many others, and this was all in about March. A New York Times article headline, "Scientists Seek Ban on Method of Editing the Human Genome." NPR started to have shows on it, All Things Considered, as followed up with some others. The MIT Technology Review had a featured story with an even more provocative title, "Engineering the Perfect Baby." So it's and if you're paying attention at all, you're just seeing it all over the news. And so we thought this would be a good topic of discussion. The way I want to go about it is first spend a little while on some of the scientific background, because it's, to me, this is one of the most important things about the Christian and science interface, is for Christians to understand the science as best they can so that our point of view can be taken with respect and seriously, because we are informed. And by being informed, then our Christian points of view really do need to be heard. And then the last part will be to go into some of the key issues, issues about ethics, safety, value, and we'll run through a lot of different things. So we've got questions along the way. Happy to have them to make sure we're all on the same page of understanding. And then I'm sure once we get into the issues, that will lead to a lot of discussion that I won't even need to talk. So here's what started that really was the proximal cause most recently. There's a paper that just came out in early April in a journal called Protein and Cell, which is not one of the high-level journals. In the sort of molecular biology field, from a group in China, titled CRISPR-Cas9 Gene Editing in Human Zygotes. And all of these stories were in March, and the reason was that people in the field were now reviewing this manuscript and some others that were being submitted to journals, so everybody became aware that this kind of work was going on. I'll give you some of the timeline of CRISPR-Cas9, this technology. But it really started the buzz when manuscripts came in, said people are trying to apply this to editing genomes in embryos. So that's why these stories predate the actual first paper. And I'm going to go into a lot of this in more detail, but what they did was take essentially a very early, just fertilized oocyte, and use this technology that I'm going to explain in a minute to edit one of the genes in the genome of the resulting embryos. And ostensibly, there was an application, one of these genetic diseases, where the hemoglobin gene is mutated, and if they could unmutate it, then these the resulting organisms, the humans in this case, wouldn't have this disease. Now, the argument was that they did it in called a tripronuclear zygote. It's basically one of the things that happens when an egg is fertilized in vitro or in vivo with multiple sperms simultaneously. So it actually starts with three nuclei instead of two. And by and large, these tripronuclear zygotes, if implanted, don't lead to viable births, although that's not universally true. There are reports that this could, in fact, lead to viable birth. Nonetheless, they didn't take it that far. So I'll go through this a little bit later. They showed that they could edit that mutant gene, but they had some issues. Off-target effects were apparent. The edited embryos were mosaic, which meant some of them got edited and some of them didn't. And so you'll see this come up when we talk about the safety issues. But this really was the tangible paper that has set everything off. All right, let me explain a little bit. I'm going to show you two static cartoons just to get you oriented. And then I'm going to show you a very nice video that will go through this in real time with a very articulate narrator. But I think if you see these cartoons first, then the video will be more meaningful. So the idea is this. If you have in your chromosome a gene that you want to edit, you want to knock it out, cause it to not transcribe into messenger RNA and protein, or replace it by another one, this new technology, and I'll explain something about its origins a little bit later, called CRISPR-Cas9. CRISPR has to do with the set of nucleic acid repeats, more or less. Cas9 is an enzyme that will cleave your DNA and create a gap, a double-strand break in it. So the way it works is if you want to cleave a particular section of the DNA, what you have to do is find what's called a guide RNA, a set of about 20 nucleic acid bases that match the target that you want to cleave. And if you get that right, then Cas9 as an enzyme will bind to that guide RNA. The guide RNA will guide it to the right location on the DNA. And once it's there, this enzyme will undertake its cleavage action and cleave it right at the location. So the guide RNA puts it in the right place, the enzyme does the cleavage. Okay. CRISPR just stands for something having to do with the DNA structure. So this is another view of it, that here's the DNA, here's the guide RNA guiding the Cas9 to the right location, undertakes its enzymatic activity and creating a break, and then a couple things can happen. There's different ways to repair the break. Cells don't like broken DNA, so they have multiple ways of repairing it. And depending on the way it's repaired, what happens to the gene is different. So there's one method of repair that essentially will just tie the two ends right there together and has essentially now deleted some of the nucleic acid sequences that are there. And so the gene, if this is designed right, just won't express. Okay, the gene is just gone. Another repair mechanism joins the broken ends and can replace them by inserting something that has the same ends. So you can actually insert another piece of DNA with a plasmid, say, that has a gene that you want with the right ends, and then it'll actually insert your gene in the place of what it took out. So you can either take something out or you can put something in. If you put something in, it can be the same gene, but mutated, or whatever. I want to show you this. If you look in the literature, you can buy these kinds of enzymes and the guide RNA informatics programs for how to do it. And if you look across the literature, they were showing that something about the efficiency. My point of showing this is the efficiency is not uniformly 100%. You've got to get this guide RNA, get the enzyme expressed in the cells you're interested in. They've got to be there at the right concentrations and find their way. And so I just want to point out that the efficiency is generally significantly less than 100%, although people are working on this, of course. Yes, sir?
I wonder also about the selectivity.
Yeah, absolutely. Selectivity is not perfect. We will get to that. Yeah, exactly. Okay, so here's a good time for the video. So I think you've got the static pictures and things make sense. Let me turn this video on for you. It's from the McGovern Institute at MIT.
Every cell in our body contains a copy of our genome, over 20,000 genes, 3 billion letters of DNA. DNA consists of two strands twisted into a double helix and held together by a simple pairing rule. A pairs with T and G pairs with C. Our genes shape who we are as individuals and as a species. Genes also have profound effects on health, and thanks to advances in DNA sequencing, researchers have identified thousands of genes that affect our risk of disease. To understand how genes work, researchers need ways to control them. Changing genes in living cells is not easy, but recently, a new method has been developed that promises to dramatically improve our ability to edit the DNA of any species, including humans. The CRISPR method is based on a natural system used by bacteria to protect themselves from infection by viruses. When the bacterium detects the presence of virus DNA, it produces two types of short RNA, one of which contains a sequence that matches that of the invading virus. These two RNAs form a complex with a protein called Cas9. Cas9 is a nuclease, a type of enzyme that can cut DNA. When the matching sequence, known as a guide RNA, finds its target within the viral genome, the Cas9 cuts the target DNA, disabling the virus. Over the past few years, researchers studying the system realized that it could be engineered to cut not just viral DNA, but any DNA sequence at a precisely chosen location by changing the guide RNA to match the target. And this can be done not just in a test tube, but also within the nucleus of a living cell. Once inside the nucleus, the resulting complex will lock onto a short sequence known as the PAM. The Cas9 will unzip the DNA and match it to its target RNA. If the match is complete, the Cas9 will use two tiny molecular scissors to cut the DNA. When this happens, the cell tries to repair the cut, but the repair process is error-prone, leading to mutations that can disable the gene, allowing researchers to understand its function. These mutations are random, but sometimes researchers need to be more precise, for example, by replacing a mutant gene with a healthy copy. This can be done by adding another piece of DNA that carries the desired sequence. Once the CRISPR system has made a cut, this DNA template can pair up with the cut ends, recombining and replacing the original sequence with the new version. All this can be done in cultured cells, including stem cells that can give rise to many different cell types. It can also be done in a fertilized egg, allowing the creation of transgenic animals with targeted mutations. And unlike previous methods, CRISPR can be used to target many genes at once, a big advantage for studying complex human diseases that are caused not by a single mutation, but by many genes acting together. These methods are being improved rapidly and will have many applications in basic research, in drug development, in agriculture, and perhaps eventually for treating human patients with genetic disease.
Feng Zheng, I'll point out, is a faculty member in our department and one of the pioneers in this.
Okay, I trust that was helpful to see it really live. Okay, so now I understand how it works. I want to point out something about the timeline. So as was mentioned in the video, this isn't normally a human or mammalian process. It was found in bacteria, as I said, as a way, essentially their immune system, the way to fight off attacking viruses or phages. So that when a phage or virus injected its DNA to try to start replicating in the cell fights back by having these Cas9 proteins that can cleave the virus DNA. And what they essentially do is store some of the cleavage products then in their own bacterial genome so that when they see it again,
they can make RNAs that then very readily will bind to the virus coming in. So they've been immunized. It's like they had their original shot. So that's where it came from. Now I want to give you the timeline. This was really discovered about the year 2000. So barely a decade ago, a decade and a half. And for about the first decade, people just try to understand how it worked on a molecular basis, what really was going on with the CRISPR and the Cas9 and the guide RNA and so forth. And so you see in 2011, really some of the first papers that say, oh, you know what, we can actually try to bring this into other organisms that it's not normally functional in. And 2013, 2 years ago, first demonstration of Cas9 gene editing in eukaryotic cells, not bacteria. It was barely 2 years ago. And so that's how fast this has happened. And there's so many, many groups working on this worldwide, both to use it and to improve its properties. So whatever I tell you about its capabilities today, that will be obsolete tomorrow. Because a new paper could come out saying, oh, we can now do this better. And so you do have to keep that in mind. That's how fast things are going. Whatever I tell you today will be superseded tomorrow. All right, so that's all good, and you can imagine lots of good research applications of it. You think of agriculture and so forth. Well, why are we having this meeting tonight about it? Because of the potential that bears on some concerns that we might have as Christians. And it starts from a good thought that if we can edit genomes at the earliest stage so that whatever we do to the genome then will be operative in the entire resulting organism, then one could correct, cure isn't the right word, is actually prevent many of these genetic diseases. So think of cystic fibrosis. Think of muscular dystrophy, Huntington's disease, sickle cell, and so forth, where there are known gene mutations that if you fix them in the adult, you'd have cured the disease. If you fix them in the embryo, you'd have prevented the disease. So that's what has people thinking about applications like this. So what's shown here is, yes, this would be a zygote right after the sperm-fertilized egg, now injecting in the Cas9, the guide RNA, and changing the genome directly in those earliest stage embryonic cells. Now, I want to put this in the context of gene therapy, because there's a lot of gene therapy research still going on and trying to move into clinical trials and clinical usage. And so this is now, this joins the approach. So I just want to point out really the context. So a number of the approaches with gene therapy would be to take something like the desired gene that you want to fix, put it in a package in a virus or a polymer, deliver it to your liver or your heart or whatever, and have that gene mutation provide that new gene or that wild type gene. You can deliver it with cells instead. You could take adult stem cells out of the body, grow them up, fix their genes, put them back in. You could take embryonic stem cells, and this is where there's been a lot of discussion ethically about embryonic stem cells, changing their genes, growing them up, and putting them back in. So this is the context in which CRISPR-Cas9 has operated, because all these things that you can do this way, by adding genes, you can also instead add the CRISPR-Cas9 system and edit your genome in any one of these type of applications. Now, the biggest concern, and this is what I'll emphasize when we get to issues, is where is one doing the gene editing? And so in conjunction with things like in vitro fertilization, the notion is if you have parents that there's concern that when you have the father sperm and the mother egg, when they're fertilized, there's a really good chance that there will be some genetic mutations existing that would lead to one of those diseases. How could you now take that original zygote and correct it using CRISPR-Cas9, for instance? So let me just follow this path, since this is the most germane to really the papers I'm going to talk about, because this is like the from the Chinese group. So created a zygote. In their case, it had three nuclei because it had been fertilized by two sperm, and then used something like CRISPR-Cas9 here to go in and repair the genes of the embryo, grow them up into blastocysts, and implant them, in the woman and have the blastocysts develop into the fetus and an embryo. So that's the cycle that people are pursuing, thinking about, and certainly pursuing in animals, as I'll show you. So one of the studies that came out about a year ago was showing how to do this in monkeys. And one thing I want to point out, what you'll find is a tremendous interest in neuroscience for using this technology in non-human primates, because studying neurological diseases is really hard, because most other animals don't have the same kind of cognitive functions we have, and of course you can't study this in humans. And so people want to understand the effects of certain genes or altering certain genes. So the interest in going into non-human primate, take a fertilized egg, a sperm, unfertilized egg, inject it with the guide RNA and the Casper, the CRISPR-Cas9, so in now this fertilized egg, this early zygote, now transfer those embryos that you've gone in and altered the gene with CRISPR-Cas9 into the mother. Some of them will in fact develop into babies. In this particular case, there were progeny produced that had come from originally altered genomes. So this is happening now, and it's happening in a variety of animals, including non-human primates. And the goal of this, as I said, is to change some of the genes and study the effects of those on neurological diseases. There's been a number of papers that you'll see, mostly mice, in which there's been demonstrated that they can correct some versions of genetic diseases. This one is actually almost a year and a half old, where what they actually created in mice was a genetic version of cataracts. So there's a particular gene that if they mutated that, the mice develop cataracts. So you can see that here. This is a normal mouse eye. Here's a mouse eye that has cataracts. They're actually quite blind. That arises from having mutated this particular gene. So then they took those mice, went back, and in embryos of those mice did CRISPR-Cas9 to correct that gene and replace it with the wild type one. And they could show that, in fact, they repaired it. The eyes were normal, no cataracts, and the mice could see by their visual tests. So you will see papers in which in mouse models, they will correct some disease using this method. Okay, so that's the scientific background. Is there anything that's not clear about the scientific background before we then go on to the related issues?
So Cas9 is a substance that does not occur in eukaryotic cells at all.
Right.
Does it linger in the cells after this procedure has occurred?
That's a good question. Generally, it's inserted as RNA, sometimes DNA, so that the cell itself will make more of it, because if you only put it in as protein, yeah, you wouldn't necessarily have enough there to do what you needed to do. So the way it's done right now, it's actually continually produced until its RNA would be degraded. So yeah, right now I'd say people haven't really followed the fate of that enzyme. Yes, sir?
You mentioned that there are several other gene therapy technologies, and so those currently do or don't actually end up changing the DNA itself of the cell versus other RNA.
Oh, they all? Okay. All the gene therapies end up affecting the genome, well,
of some cells. Sometimes it integrates on the chromosome, sometimes it doesn't. There's different ways of delivering that gene. Let's say, for sake of argument, some of them do integrate into the chromosome. Okay, so the main issue isn't necessarily whether it's in the chromosome, it's what type of cells it's put into. But yeah, just about all gene therapy are changing the genetic content.
So, I'd imagine that there might be other technologies also in the pipeline besides Cas9.
Yeah, in fact, there were two already, zinc fingers and TALENs. If anybody's in the biotech field, you'll have heard of those before. If you haven't, don't worry about it too much. But they essentially do the same thing, just are more cumbersome to develop. Zinc fingers, you actually have to create new proteins that are very specific for DNA. TALENs are more effective. In fact, there's some arguments. Let me just say that there's some arguments between the comparative effectiveness of TALENs and CRISPR-Cas9. But right now, CRISPR-Cas9 is sort of zoomed past as the method of seemingly greater power. But yeah, there are others. Okay, let's go into the issues. And I broke them down here. I'm going to talk a little bit about ethics first. Mainly want to emphasize germline cells versus somatic cells. Then we'll talk a little bit about safety. And then we'll talk about the actual value of it, and then we'll go back to some of the other ethical issues. And hopefully this will stir a lot of thoughts on your part. Okay, so first this. Okay, want to emphasize the very, very profound distinction between altering the genome in a germline cell versus somatic cells. So somatic cells are essentially all the other cells in your body that aren't really the hereditary line, eggs, sperm, zygotes, embryos. Because for all the other cells of the body, when you die, your cells die. And there's nothing in your genome that's going to get passed on to anybody else. The only thing in your genome that gets passed on to anybody else is if it's in your oocytes, your eggs, or your sperm. Okay, then if you have offspring, that gets passed on. So this is, in my view, in most people's view, the most profound difference, that you can imagine doing anything you want in a somatic cell, and maybe you've caused harm. You don't know the cost-benefit ratio to the individual in which you do that, but that individual then doesn't pass it on to anybody else. Whereas if it's done in the germline, egg, sperm, zygote, embryo, then it's now feasible for it to be passed on to the next generation, and whatever the consequences are of that, they're kind of irreversible. Okay, so that's a very important, and I want to make this clear, because sometimes the technologies look similar. So for instance, what I've just been talking about, and this is what the Chinese group did, and the monkey group did, and the mouse group did, is to take a sperm and an egg, and the fertilized egg, and at some point, usually at the blastocyst stage, where before, this would be in vitro, before implantation, introduce the gene editing here, and then implant the blastocyst into the womb and generate the fetus and the resulting organism. There's many technologies that do the same thing, up to even the embryo blastocyst stage, but settle for just growing stem cells out of those embryos, growing them up to some other type of cell, a nerve cell, a pancreatic cell, a liver cell, a blood cell, and then putting those cells back in the body. So if you did CRISPR-Cas9 this way, okay, you're altering the genome, but only of somatic cells that are not going to be passed down the progeny. Okay, so even if it looks like I'm still using embryonic stem cells, I'm still growing up blastocysts, I'm still editing these, it makes all the difference in the world whether you just take the cells and grow them up or whether you actually implant. Yeah?
Do you know for sure that if we edit the genes in, say, a nerve cell, that there's no way those edited genes are going to come out via RNA or something and affect other cells? Or
Yeah, I think that's pretty clear. That from somatic cells, their chromosomes don't get passed on back into germline. Okay, so one of the other issues of this then arise in the same way, and I just want to make sure that this is on the table from the Christian point of view, is what are the sources of these cells that you would edit? Well, by and large, it's from in vitro fertilization, that one has fertilized eggs, grows them up in culture to a blastocyst form, does the editing here before implantation. So, depending on your point of view of the source of those embryos. Okay, so if a fertilized egg, a sperm fertilized egg, then is an individual, a human life at that point, well then no matter which way you do it, you have an issue with the source of the cells. Okay, so with the germline editing, you kind of get both simultaneously. You worry about the source of the cells from in vitro fertilization embryos and keeping the ones you want, throwing out the ones you don't want, and then the fact that what you do in the germline, in fact, can be inherited. So sort of square some of the issues. Okay. All right, so that is one thing I wanted to emphasize is, and again, this to me, this comes from a part of the thinking of, do we have issues with all of CRISPR-Cas9 genome editing? Well, there's a difference between somatic and germline. You can decide what you want to think about them both, but they're not identical. Okay, safety. We're going to talk about mainly unintended consequences and where they come from. And there's really three categories: off-target effects, gene color variation effects, and just general lack of predictive capability. So off-target effects, and somebody had asked about this before, along with lack of complete efficiency, this is the other main technical problem. And that is, so these days, if you do your bioinformatics and you look across somebody's entire genome, you can design a 20 nucleic acid sequence that's essentially unique in that genome. There's a little bit of a caveat that we can come back to that I won't raise right now. But what's been found is that if you have not quite a perfect match, you might match 19 out of 20 or 18 out of 20 or 17 out of 20, there's still some affinity for a guide RNA than with some other stretch of the DNA that they're just a few bases off. So that means even though you might claim my target is unique in the genome, there are many other places in the genome that are close enough that you might really get some effects. And that's what's found. And here's again another one of the commercial technology sites for CRISPR-Cas9. And they're just recounting across many papers, people have studied how many off-target effects they get and so forth. And the answer is they're significant. And this is probably the biggest thing people are working on in the field technically is how to reduce these off-target effects. And there's lots of groups reducing it and reducing it and reducing it. But right now, this is a significant problem.
Why is it limited to 20?
That's okay, good. That's the way the original bacterial system works. So one thing people are working on now is can we change it and design things that are just 17 nucleic acids, for instance, and if we can get them to be unique with the right kind of design, then we shouldn't have the off-target effects. So that's one of the things people are playing with right now, is actually changing it from 20. Exactly. Yeah, so I'm very confident that this is a problem that will be solved. I mean, this is just a technical thermodynamics problem. This is a polymer interacting with another polymer, and how you design it so that. All right, what's wrong with that?
Okay. Well, it's an information theoretic thing, too. You have an encoding going on, it's not a read-solve encoding.
Yeah, well, that's true. But in the cell, the chances of it happening actually has to do with the energetics. So.
But what are the, yes, there are single nucleotide polymorphisms. So does that play a role
yes.
at all in the recognition and just, how it might be
contained? Exactly. When I said a minute ago there was a caveat, okay, that's exactly what it is. So right now, let's say I want to edit something in Randy's genome. If I don't have his sequence, and I just get the reference sequence that's out there from Craig Venter or Jim Watson or something, and I design it for that gene based on the reference sequence, okay, I might have even more off-target effects in Randy, because he might have enough single nucleotide polymorphisms that there are a number of other places where there's 17 matches or 18 matches or 19 matches or even 20 matches. So to really get this right, yeah, if I want to do the therapy in Randy, I really need to sequence Randy. Okay, because otherwise I'm going to get off-target effects just by not having his full genome.
And also, are there
I don't know. Happy to open that to Craig or Shelley or Natasha, if any of you know that. I don't know that. Okay, these are things having to do with...
I will write that down, and I will ask them all.
Yeah, okay. All right, so my point here, and the reason I just threw up a few papers is just to point out how active this area is. Everybody's trying to improve the selectivity, because that's what everybody's worried about. Some of it's informatics, some of it's biochemistry, and so forth. So when I go back to their original paper, in their abstract, it pointed out that the efficiency was low, the edited embryos were mosaic. I had talked about that before with respect to the efficiency, that when it was put into the blastocyst, it didn't correct all of the cells that were there, and so it was mosaic. That some of the tissues that resulted had the correction and some didn't. So that had to do with efficiency. And then, highlighted here, off-target cleavage was also apparent, and that goes back to this selectivity. So when they went in and looked, yes, they found off-target mutations in many places. All right, second issue beyond off-target effects is the notion of gene covariation. And that is, okay, you think you want to fix a hemoglobin gene or a cystic fibrosis gene, and you're going to get that right, so they're not going to get that disease. Is there any certainty that there's not some coupling with some other gene that then affects physiology in a way? How could that be? Well, there are examples of this known. One has to do with HIV and the... And some of the receptors that HIV binds to. This is the most well-known, the association between the sickle cell hemoglobin gene and malaria resistance. And what people had presumed for some time and have now done a lot of interesting studies, both mechanistically and kind of epidemiologically, that the sickle cell hemoglobin gene that makes it difficult for red blood cells to accept oxygen, and that's underlies that disease, is more frequently found in the same areas that malaria is prevalent. And you can kind of look at it geographically, you can do calculations of what's the degree of malaria prevalence versus what's the proportion of frequency of this sickle cell mutant gene. And there's mechanistic reasons why this is true, because the malaria parasite has to live within red blood cells. And if the red blood cells have the sickle cell hemoglobin gene mutation, then it's harder for the malaria parasites to survive. So let's just say you decided you wanted to go in and correct the sickle cell hemoglobin gene. That would be a very nice thing to prevent that disease. But then you better stay out of the locations where malaria is, because then you would actually be more susceptible. So you could say, well, there's one example. We'll just avoid that one. The question is, how many more of these couplings are there with gene covariations? And I'm certain they're not all discovered. I'm certain it's not clear how to discover them. These days, with all the human genome sequencing efforts and so forth, I think more will arise. Okay, so that's, even if you had it perfect efficiency, perfect, no off-target effects, if you have some gene covariation issues, then something's going to happen. And then lastly, this is the kind of work I do. I do a lot of signal transduction, network regulation. And the biggest issue with biology these days is there's just a general lack of predictability.
Okay, so even if you don't have some precise gene-to-gene sequence covariation, nobody can tell you that if I go in and edit this gene, what all the possible interactions are, hundreds of thousands between other the gene products in a cell, and what the consequences of that are going to be. For a pathology, it can be very environmental dependent. And so the bottom line is that any of this is totally uncertain. Even if you have perfect efficiency, even if you know off-target effects, even if you're certain there's no gene covariation, some things can happen that will be adverse consequences. And the interesting question is, how would you ever test for this? How would you do the experiment to say, okay, this is safe enough, and I'll just leave that there for right now. So that's a big question. All right, let's talk about value, almost done. So I gave you a list of you would go into in vitro in vitro fertilization and correct some genes. These days, if you're going to do in vitro fertilization already, you can look for embryos that have mutations or don't have mutations. So I just pulled this off the web. This is just one of the fertility centers in California. And these are all the genetic diseases that they will do a diagnosis on from your embryonic blastocyst. So they'll go in, select a trophoblastic cell or two. They won't do a full genome sequence, but they know what to look for with all of these different variants. And if they find one of these, then that embryo will just be not selected for implantation. Okay? So, given that if you have any potential risks from the parents, there are methods now that just routinely, this prenatal genetic diagnosis, to go in and make sure that before you implant an embryo, it doesn't have the mutations you're worried about. Now you say, well, okay, you can't catch all of them. We're not that far away. Single cell, full genome sequencing is on its way. It's just a matter of time before one could go in and take one of the cells from the blastocyst and do a full genome sequencing on it and make sure there's nothing in there you don't want. Okay, so if that's the case, then the question is, why do you need to go in and do the CRISPR-Cas9 editing? Because you have to take one of these embryos, fix it in vitro. Before you put it back in, you'd probably sequence it anyway to make sure that you got it right and what the off-target effects. So why not take the embryos that already exist and just don't select the ones that have what you don't want? Is there really, in fact, any benefit of doing CRISPR-Cas9 that you can't already get from the genetic diagnosis? Most of the people in the field right now, they will admit that. They say, yeah, it sounds good, but when you think about it, there actually is no extra medical benefit from editing the genome versus sequencing and selecting. Now, you could think about that and say, well, if I'm doing sequencing and selecting, then maybe I'm throwing out a lot more embryos, and that's a bad thing, and I'd rather have fewer and edit them. Okay, but that's to think about. All right, finally, one last thing on ethics, desirable traits. We've been talking about diseases. Of course, many people's imaginations can jump to height and strength and cosmetic things, intelligence. You know, are there any traits that we want to instill into our offspring? And so what I've shown here is just a poll that right now, about a year ago, the Pew Foundation did a study, and people thought, well, if you could genetically modify babies, maybe 50% thought it was worthwhile to reduce the risk of serious disease, you know, I just talked about whether or not that actually exists, to do something cosmetically, okay, most of folks would be against that. So does it actually matter what the purpose is? Are there good purposes and bad purposes? That's a part of the ethics. All right. So
let me end by saying where we are with respect to the ethics and the community. So in all those articles I started with, they were mainly focused on a meeting that was held out in California in March by a number of leaders in the areas of stem cells and molecular biology and so forth. Very much intended to be like the Asilomar conference in 1975 when first recombinant DNA came out, and they said, we've got to self-police this. So this group came together and said, what do we think should happen? Well, one, should strongly discourage clinical application, not forever, but at this time. And I'll go into why in a minute. Create forums for education and discussion. We're doing that. Encourage more research to evaluate how well it works. And that's what I was talking about before. So many people working on selectivity and efficiency and so forth. And hold more meetings, especially internationally, because this is one thing to think about the guidelines are in the U.S., but what about elsewhere? But their bottom line was this potential safety and efficacy issues arising from the use of this must be investigated and understood before any attempts at human engineering are sanctioned, if ever. So that's sort of the point of the scientific community. Let me skip this for now. What I have is an interview from Jennifer Doudna, who was she actually called that meeting, and she's one of the inventors of this. And so she went into some discussion of what the discussion was at that meeting. Let me just land on this one. What if somebody goes rogue? What if we had all the laws we wanted? The entire world had laws against doing this. There's still no way to stop anybody who wanted to do it. Because if you can get a source of embryos, this molecular technology is easy. There's no way to stop somebody from doing it. So that's a very interesting question. Whatever laws you want, even if they're universal, it still could happen, and you might argue it's still very likely to happen. What is the status of regulation? So there's a number of companies in red where genome editing human embryos is prohibited. Other countries in which there's guidelines. Interestingly, China falls into the realm in which there's guidelines, even though that's where the bulk of the activity is going on right now. And there's suspicions that a lot of activity is going on in China having to do with CRISPR-Cas9 embryonic editing. The U.S. Is noted here in gray as restrictive. Let me just make sure we're on the same page of what exists in the U.S. So a very recent article summarizing from Francis Collins, the director of the NIH, because of all this attention over the last couple months, Dr. Collins obviously thought it would be very important to just reiterate where NIH stands on this. So, NIH will not fund any use of gene editing technologies in human embryos. The concept of altering human genome and embryos for clinical purposes has been debated over many years and has been viewed almost universally as a line not to be crossed. Strong arguments exist against engaging in this activity, not research, but clinical human applications, is what he's meaning. Unquantifiable safety issues, and I talked about that. Ethical issues by altering germline affects the next generation. Pointing out informed consent. Sometimes in medicine we think about informed consent. Okay, the embryo is really not capable of informed consent. And then this I've explained, but Dr. Collins says this, a current lack of medical applications justifying the use. And I explained why that's the case. Practically, there are existing legislative and regulatory prohibitions. So along with what I talked about on the previous slide about NIH, the Dickey-Wicker Amendment prohibits the use of funds for creation of human embryos for purposes in which human embryos are destroyed. Pretty much have to do this to be studying the human embryonic applications. NIH guidelines on their common DNA advisory committee will not at present entertain proposals for germline alteration. FDA has the authority to regulate these kind of products, all cell and therapy products, and this would fall under that. So
in the end, if somebody ever wanted to really do this, the FDA could prohibit it. So I think that's the end of what I have. So maybe I'll just go back to the issues outline, and we can have a discussion from there. So open the floor. Thanks.